Accession number 20602, Reel 2.
Bob Palmer, Reel 2.
None of us had seen this gun, but it was really quite close to us, I would think. It was only about 40 yards away, which was very close, really. But we hadn't seen it because it was highly scrimmaged up. It was in a concealed area where lots of trees were and all sorts of camouflage over it. So that's why we hadn't seen it. But he was so close and he fired at us and hit us. And when he hit us, the whole of our vehicle sort of rocked sideways. What happened was, on the front off side of our vehicle, we had a great big metal toolbox welded to the chassis. And where his shell landed, it landed right at the join of where the weld was. And it shot this thing away, the toolbox and all its contents, and we never, ever saw them again. How far they went or what happened, we don't know, but they dislodged it from the tank and it was sent right away. So we never, ever saw that again. But we were lucky in a sense. He was using, obviously, armour-piercing shots, so it didn't explode, so none of us got hurt. But it sort of, what shall I say, shook us in the sense that there we were being shot at by this German anti-tank gun. I've no idea what it was officially called, but I would imagine it was something like what we called an ordinary British two-pounder anti-tank type gun, I was what I think it was, that sort of thing. So, of course, I instructed the driver then. I said, reverse hard on your left hand. So he reversed hard on his left hand until we were facing the thing. And then I gave the instruction to fire, and we fired at it, and this was a very easy target for us. It was only about 40 yards away. And so we hit that fair and square in the middle with no trouble at all, and it exploded, and that put that out of action quite quickly. No trouble at all, but there were about, I don't know how many, three, maybe four again, people who were survived from that, who came running away from it. And when they did, members of the Hampshire Regiment again grabbed hold of them and made them prisoners of war. Well, this had only just happened, split second sort of thing, and then over the radio I get a message, Sergeant Palmer, proceed along the track and look for an officer from the Sherwood Rangers Yeomanry. He will be waiting for you. So we go along this track a bit further, and there's this officer, who of course I didn't know, but he was an officer, and he was standing there while he was up. He came over to where we were, and I leaned over the side of the turret and spoke to him. And he said, down there, you can see those two great big houses. There were two great big houses, posh-looking houses. So I said, yeah. He said, well, they're both heavily fortified, and they are both making a great nuisance of themselves. They've already knocked out about six Bren gun carriers and killed off a lot of our ground troops. So please deal with them. So we drove down to them. When we got nearly to, sort of, you know, 50 yards away or something like that, and in easy range anyway, I could see that they weren't ordinary houses at all. What had happened was they were ordinary houses to start with, but then they'd been piled up with masses of concrete all around the windows. You could see the windows were deeply inset, so to speak, because the heavy amount of concrete that they'd got added to the original side of it. So I looked and I could see movement in the upstairs right window of this first one. So I said to the layout, put it in the off side, in the front right hand side window upstairs. So he fired the first shot in, and that went in through the window and exploded. And when it did, within seconds, a whole pile of people, about 10, I think, maybe 12, came running out of the side door on the ground floor. And as they did, of course, the infantry boys from the Hampshires were busy rubbing their hands, and they collected those as prisoners, took them away and made prisoners of them. So that was sort of, you know, quite nice as far as they were concerned. The infantry were very pleased. They bagged up quite a nice lot of prisoners now from these three different guns. So then I said to them, I said, well, in that left-hand one house, I haven't seen any movement, so put this one in through the front door. So they fired the shot in through the front door, and it was comical, really, if you saw it. People immediately started diving out of the windows upstairs. Some of them came out from round the back, and some dived out of the windows upstairs. onto the ground, you know, so they had a whole story to drop down onto their feet. And again, the infantry boys from the Hampshires busily engaged them and took them prisoners as well. And as a result of all that, there was a whole collection of prisoners that they was collected from that house and the other one and from the two guns that had already been knocked out. But where we were lucky and privileged and fortunate, it meant within a very, very short space of time, we'd been able to knock out four different gun emplacements or guns of theirs, of the Germans, and hadn't got hurt ourselves. So we were very, very fortunate. The good Lord was kind to us. I've always said this. I didn't personally do all this. Of course I didn't. I was the one who was in charge, and I had to decide what to do and give the orders in order to do it. But I would never have got away with it had it not been for my very good first-class crew who'd been excellently trained and did exactly what they were told very, very quickly. And it was only because of their efficiency that we were able to finish up in this fortunate way, knocking out four guns like that. So everyone was extremely pleased with us, of course, for that. In fact, later on, I don't know how on earth he managed to get the paint, but one of our gunners scrounged some paint from somewhere and he painted the colours of the military medal on the side of our tank, because a few days afterwards I was sent for and I was told that the King, as he was then, the King had awarded me the military medal, which is, it says on the medal, for gallantry in the field. And only about 3 weeks afterwards, I think it was, I went to a place called Jerusalem in Normandy, not the other Jerusalem, a place called Jerusalem in Normandy, quite near to where we'd been. And General Montgomery, who was then our senior one, he presented me with the military medal and pinned it on. And I've got a photograph, of course, of him in our group. But it was lucky, and it turned out that I was the first member of our regiment to be awarded a medal. So, you know, I was an honoured man and very privileged.
Can you remember who was in your crew?
Yes, difficult, I think, yes. I had a chap called Lance Sergeant Gherkin, was my number two, he was my deputy. A chap called Don Sadler was my number three, he's as the man who does the firing and the manoeuvring of the gun in position. A chap called Len Chappell was my number four. Number five, I had a man who I didn't really know very well. He only came to me just before we took part in the invasion. And at the moment, his name escapes me. And as I say, we had our Sergeant Major, Herbert Broom, on board, acted as one of the gunners as well, although he was a Sergeant Major, a rank above me. He came ashore as a gunner and acted as a gunner under my orders. So I was very fortunate. All these chaps were extremely, extremely capable, well-trained. Unfortunately, one of them, Les Giddings, died shortly afterwards. The only one I see fairly regularly, once a year now, I normally see Don Sadler, who was the number four. I do see him because when I go to these reunions to various places, he sometimes has been there. And he came here a few years ago and stayed here for overnight so that we could attend together. But the others, I haven't been able to contact. In fact, I've even been to Manchester to try and run down my driver because he lived in Manchester, in Radford Road, as it was called. But I haven't been able to find him. What happened was the whole of Radford Road, for whatever reason, was demolished and the people from there were sent to other parts. But although I've contacted the local council, I haven't been able to find out where this family went. Not with, you know, my driver in. So I've never been able to contact my driver. I have contacted, as I say, my number four. I did see the number three, but who's now died, unfortunately. I've never, ever seen the number two, and I've tried hard to get in touch with him, but I haven't been able to. I can't find him. I don't know where he is. Tried all sorts of things to try and get in touch, but I can't. But that is one of those things, isn't it? Yeah.
So the driver came from Manchester. Do you remember where the others came from?
Well, the Sergeant Major was from Colchester. The driver was from Manchester. The one who died, Les Giddings, the number three, he came from can't think of the name of the place, somewhere quite near to Peterborough. They weren't all thoroughbred Essex people, you know, because they built us up with numbers from all over the place as the war progressed. And Gherkin, Alec Gherkin, he came from, near to Preston somewhere in Lancashire, but I can't think of the name of the place. Small place near Preston, I can't think of the name of it. And another one was there from Scarborough. Sadler was from Scarborough. That's it. I can't remember anymore. It's been a nightmare to me to think that I haven't been able to contact all of the crew. I've tried very hard, I really have, but I haven't been able to. But as I say, there's two of them that I've seen, the one I don't know very well, and Don Sadler that I do know very well. We get together now, sort of, certainly every second year anyway, for to get together too. But the others we can't trace, and he's tried as well, but we haven't been able to find them where they are.
Now, can you take me a bit further to what happened to you after you attacked that strong point?
Well, after we attacked the four things. The big thing was the strong point, of course, the 88mm gun, which was the Germans' favourite gun, as I'm sure you know. That was the big thing. The next one, of course, was the armour-piercing thing, which they had as an anti-tank gun, whatever that was. And then, of course, the next two were the two machine guns in the fortified houses. Well, after we'd done that, we were pulled out of the line to get something to eat and drink, sort of thing. I think it was our major, a battery major, who's now dead, a chap called Bluey Lyon. He called us out and said, you know, you people have earned a break. Go and take an hour or so off and get something to eat and drink. So we took ourselves out of the action, so to speak, and got ourselves something to eat and drink. And then they said, right, we're going to try and head towards Bayeux. We've got to try and make Bayeux tonight if we can. Well, now, the thing was, we were not able to get to Bayeux that night. We headed off in the direction of Bayeux, but we didn't get very far, and we met heavy opposition, and we couldn't get on. So we had to lay about quite near to the beaches for, I suppose, 2 days. Then at the end of that, we were moved on to a place called Hill or Point 103, which became a very famous part in the Battle of Normandy. It's where we were first introduced to German Tiger tanks and King Tiger tanks. They dealt with us with what they used as airburst shells over the top of you. Whereas normally, you know, if the shells are dropping, if you're in a hole by the side of the road sort of thing, you dug a trench like a little grave and got in it, if a shell exploded somewhere near you, it didn't hurt you because the blast went over the top of you in your ditch. But if you've got an airburst thing, that's a different thing altogether. It bursts above you, and if you're in a ditch or if you're just laying on the ground or walking about, it gets you. And that's what happened. They gave us a bad, bad time at Hill 103, and we lost an officer. Our Sergeant Major, Herbert Broom, the one who came with me, he was killed. So was one of our officers, and I think three of our chaps, all killed at the command post, all with one direct shell from one of these German Tiger tanks. As a result of that, that was, I think, on D+4, I think it was, about D+4 anyway. Because the Sergeant Major was killed, it so happened I was the senior sergeant in the battery, so I was immediately promoted to be Sergeant Major. So from that minute on, I became Sergeant Major and was sort of taken off the gun, and my assistant, a chap called Antrobus from Cheshire, he took over the gun as number one.
So what were your duties from then on?
Well, I was a Sergeant Major. That means you're in charge. You've got four guns in your troop, about 76 people, if I remember rightly, in the troop. And your job is to organise the movement of them, where they're going to go and what's going to happen, where they're going to go and what sort of targets they've got to take on, in conjunction with your officers who are further forward in what they call observation posts. They would contact me by radio and say that they were at a certain point and say where they wanted fire brought down on. And they could, if they wanted, from where they stood, they could give direct orders to us to feed into the guns, so the guns could move to the left or right, whatever, and different ranges up and down, different angles to sight, to fire on targets. But what my job as a sergeant major would be then, once they were in action, was to go along in front of each of these guns, once I've heard what the bearings are that have been given, say they say they're going to fire at 202 degrees, 40 minutes or something, well then all you do with that, you take away 180 degrees, stand in front of the gun, and then with your compass, you line it up and check it, and of course allow for magnetic variation. And then you can easily check whether the gun is firing in approximately the right sort of direction. If it's miles off beam, you know, you can spot it immediately and say, stop, stop, stop. If, on the other hand, it's firing reasonably accurately, well, then that's within your compass workings out. And it's quite easy then to see that the things are all right. Then you're responsible, if you like, for their general well-being. And one of the things, I well remember this ever so well, obviously we were badly shaken after this horrible explosion at Hill 103, when so many of our chaps and the officer and the sergeant major were all killed. That knocked us about a bit pretty badly. I can tell you everybody felt, you know, horrid about that. And I thought, what the hell can I do to try and cheer these buggers up, you know? Well, in those days, of course, the sergeant major used to ride a motorbike. Well, luckily, I could ride a motorbike, so it was easy for me. I got on this bloody motorbike and off I went. And I found a farmyard, only about, I don't know, a quarter of a mile perhaps, 600 yards, from our gun position, where we were last in. When I got to this farmyard, I was struggling on my way, because I'm not very good at French, but I was struggling with my words about, you know, who are you, you know, the rang and the burr sort of thing. I was struggling to try and, what am I going to say and how am I going to say it? When I got there, it was quite laughable, really, at this farmhouse. A young lady of about 18 or 20 opened the door, smiled at me, and of course I started off struggling with my French, trying to say, have you got bread and milk and things like this? And she said in beautiful English, would it be easier if we spoke in English? Well, it may sound silly, but for a moment, truthfully, I was so stunned I couldn't talk in any language. it really caught me out. But anyway, I was invited into the house. I went into the house, and sure enough, yes, we got some fresh eggs and some butter and some milk, and I took them back. I thought that would cheer our chaps up quite a lot, which it did. And oddly enough, there was a boy in the house who was a lot younger than me. I was then about, what, 23. And this lad would be about 16 or 17. Through the years, I have been in touch with him since, and from time to time, I'm still in touch with him now. And in fact, he has been to my house. Before I moved here, I lived at Chelmsford. He's been over and spent a holiday with us at Chelmsford. He's also been over here with his father and been to this house. And a few years ago, on one of the trips when I went back, I went and looked him up. I had my son with me, and we went and looked him up where he was and spent some time with him again. So I've kept in touch, really, with him all those years ago, that boy. And I'm hoping that if I'm able, I hope I'm going to be well enough to go back on the 60 years after. I've been at many. I went 20 years after was the first time I went back. Then I did 25 years, 30 years, 35, 40 years, 45 years, 50 years. And in addition, on one occasion, I think it was 1979, my beloved wife was still alive then. I'd been on television, of course, for BBC and since then on Anglia. And in the earlier days, I'd been on American television, French television, Canadian television, all about this thing. And pieces had been written in books about it. There's articles about this thing. And I'd been on radio broadcast, and I'd been indoors at home interviewed by a radio man when my wife was present. And, you know, she'd heard the interview sort of thing. And at one stage, and I think this was 1979, she suddenly said to me, this thing had come up again on the radio. She said, oh, you know, Bob, she said, I've heard such a lot about it. I've read a lot about it. What I'd like to do, I think I'd like to see it. So I said, well, all right then, sure, of course we can. And I thought, this was October she was talking about, and I'm sure it was 79. October, I thought she was meaning, what, next June, you know. So I said, well, we go over for a holiday in June, shall we? Well, no, she said, why don't we go now? So as a result, the next day, I mean, things were different then. I was physically fit and able and quite capable. We got in the car and off we went. 2 days later, there we were, and I've got a photograph in there of her standing beside the blockhouse to prove it. And I'm sure that was 1979, October 79.
So, if we can go back to the story, you said you had this amusing encounter with the civilian who spoke good English. What happened after this?
Well, after that, we were on duty sort of in that area and still moving as best we could towards Bayeux. But it took us several days to finally get to Bayeux. And one thing I remember ever so well, we were filthy dirty. It was very hot. And we were filthy dirty, and everybody was sort of praying for the opportunity for a swim or a bath or something. And suddenly it happened. Up came this great big army vehicle, a big tank. And it got some, like, I suppose they were rubber tubes, bicycle tubes, coming out the top of it. And you could have about 6 or 7 people standing around the side, all having a shower bath at the same time from this tank of water. And what was so funny, I well remember this, we were standing there all stripped off completely, you know, having a shower down through these bicycle tubes, getting ourselves freshened up and cleaned, and a whole pile of French women went by. And of course they stopped and looked. They didn't seem to take much notice at all, but they just stopped and looked. And of course, you know, we didn't know what to sort of say or do. We felt a bit foolish, I think. But that was it. They stood and watched us. And then a few days after that, when we got into Bayeux itself, one of the first pleasurable things that happened to me, we were invited to go and have a proper bath. And they took our whole troop together into this bathhouse. What they didn't do, they didn't tell us what was going to happen. They just said, would you like a bath? And of course, we all said yes. And of course, we'd all got this pink soap that we used to get, Lifebuoy type soap that you used to get issued with. And so what happens, you get in this bath, about, I suppose, 20 of us all together in a room about as big as this with all the overhead showers. The showers are turned on and we rub ourselves down with all this pink soap in our hair and all over our bodies and things. And suddenly the water stopped. So of course we called out and they said, no, you have had. So whether we were on a specific timing or what, I don't know, but they never told us that first. So if you can picture it, there we all were, smothered with this reddish or pinkish coloured soap all over us. And in those days, I had a mass of hair. I had enough hair for about 4 men. Couldn't get it off. It was horrible. So we had a bad, bad time trying to get that cleared off, and that stuck in my memory ever since. Took me ages to get back to my skin again after that. But that was just a silly little interlude, I suppose, something you laugh about afterwards. You didn't laugh about it at the time. We were so thrilled on the one hand to be able to have a bath, but we were so upset on the other hand not to be able to have it properly and get cleaned up.
And then, what do you remember happening next?
Well, we were part of what was called the 8th Armoured Brigade, which was in 50 Div. And what had happened was, apparently, the 8th Armoured Brigade had been very impressed by the work of our 25-pounder self-propelled guns. The reason being, we could be used as an ordinary sort of field gun. We could be used as a howitzer to fire up and over, you know, that sort of thing. We could be used as a tank gun, so we could fire direct over sights at tanks or obstructions, whatever they were, that sort of thing. And as a result, the leaders of the 8th Armoured Brigade decided that what they wanted these guns to do was to take the lead on each occasion. So whichever group was in command, they had us as their steersman at the front, if you like. And we changed from different regiments. I remember we moved over from one regiment to another. And when we eventually got, after that Bridge Too Far trip, when we got to Nijmegen in Holland, we were trying desperately, of course, to get to Arnhem. I'm sure you know the story of all of that, the Bridge Too Far. We got as far as the bridge at Arnhem, and I went over the Bridge of Arnhem as one of the early birds over the Bridge at Arnhem. And I do remember this. We went over with the Brigade of Guards, who's ever so well documented about this, they are, for that bridge. But we went over with them, but then we couldn't get any further. The Germans were stopping us. You know, we'd run out more or less of ammunition and food and supplies and stuff, because as we'd been travelling along, each time we passed one of these bridges, what had happened, we'd left some more men and some more munitions and some more food behind. So by the time we got up to Nijmegen, we were pretty well out of food and all the essentials, and also get running short on ammunition. And the thing I remember at Nijmegen Bridge in particular, ever so strange thing I'll never forget, while we were by the side of the bridge, by the water, we suddenly saw four men who turned out to be German divers. We saw four men in complete, what do you call it when they got a complete...
Frog suit?
No. Like long pants with tops on, that type of thing, all over them, complete. So they were filled in, the whole of their bodies were covered with a woolen type garment.
Combination,
that's the word I was trying to think of. And they were brought up out of the water. Apparently what happened was they were in there swimming, trying to put mines against the bridge to blow the bridge up. But some of the infantry had found them and pulled them out. And I remember seeing them being marched out in front of the guns of the infantrymen, and they walked right past us. But they were unlucky in their venture. They weren't able to put the bombs onto the bridge as they wanted to, so of course the bridge stayed intact. It wasn't blown up. But it's a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful bridge, and I've got some lovely pictures of it somewhere. I remember it ever so well. And of course, that's as far as I actually managed to get. Regrettably, I had a terrible, terrible thing happen to me. I got horrible sores all over my face and on my neck. And they took me into hospital at Nijmegen, kept me in there for, I don't know, a week or something like that. And then they decided they couldn't cure me. I'd got what they called... Oh dear, my memory fails me now. Can't think of the word. It really means Barber's rat, psychosis barbae. I was diagnosed as having psychosis barbae. I got all these horrible spots here everywhere I shaved, horrible, horrible spots. And every time you shave, of course, you cut the tops off the spots and they were all bleeding. It was an awful mess. And they put me in and they put this mauve stuff, Jensen Violet, I think they call it, all over my face to try to cure it, but they couldn't. They kept me in the hospital about a week, and then they said, we're sorry, but we can't keep it here. You'll have to go back. So they sent me back by air to Brussels. And that was quite an experience. When they got us to go on this aeroplane, it was a... I've got a picture of it in the hall, and I can't think of the name of it. Hanley Page Hamden. It was a Hanley Page Hamden aircraft that we were being evacuated by. And when I climbed aboard, the skipper on board the aircraft, he looked at me, and of course I was wearing my Sergeant Major's crown. He said, welcome aboard, Sergeant Major. He said, as you're a Sergeant Major, I presume you can read a map. So I said, well, yes, of course. Right, he said, you're my observer then. So I sat up next to the pilot, in the cockpit as his observer. And then he said, we've got to go from here and you've got to lead the way to Brussels. There's a map. He gave me this map. He said, but bear this in mind, we mustn't go higher than 1,000 feet to begin with, because the German troops are each side of the road. And if we go higher than 1,000 feet, they'll be able to pick us off. So we've got to stay as low as we can, near the ground as we can, and travel on. So we did that. And of course, as far as I was concerned, it was a lot easier reading a map from up there than what it was on a motorbike, because you've got on the one hand your map, and then you look down there and you see a bigger version of your map. So it was ever so, as far as I was concerned, ever so easy to find my way from there to Brussels, no trouble at all. But at least, you know, that was one of the things I was called upon to do, and I was luckily able to do it, and I loved it. When we got to Brussels, I remember, we were surrounded by lots and lots and lots and lots of women, all came round cheering and clapping and that, and they were bringing drinks round in jugs and glasses and things, and we were leaning over the side accepting these drinks and things. And then they took us into a hospital there, and they gave us lots of grapes, which went down ever so well, really did go down well. I was very pleased with that. A lovely bunch of grapes they gave each of us in turn, you know. Well, I stayed in there, I don't know how long, a few days, 3 days, I think. And then they said, no, you're going to be sent home to England because they can't cure this thing here. You've got to get back to England. So they sent me back on a hospital ship. And when we landed, I was taken to a place called Park Pruitt Hospital, which I'm certain really is in Hampshire.